Welcome to episode 79 of The Infectious Myth. I'm David Crow, your host, and I'm glad you're with me again. You can find us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. There you can join the discussion. You can also follow us on Twitter, at infectiousmyth. Send me an email at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Today's guest will talk to us about addiction based on his personal experiences, both as an addict in his youth and as a neuroscientist in his maturity. He will talk about his two books, one autobiographical and his 2015 book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. But before I get to Mark, how about a little feedback? Donald wrote to me on Facebook, great show, and he's referring to number 78, the interview with Amy Pova, but very upsetting. Just wondered how differently she would approach her trial now. Did she take the stand? Is there a way to ask for jury nullification? Could she be more aggressive with the informant, etc.? Those are excellent questions. I'm not very educated on any legal system, American, Canadian, or others, so I really can't answer them myself. But I would certainly be interested in talking to a guest who's worked with people charged with drug crimes and who could discuss possibly strategies to mitigate a strong attack from the war on drug authorities. So if anybody has a suggestion for a guest in this area, I'd like it, and I think Donald would also like to hear about this. And in news of the week, the Associated Press has an article on a new poll that they did on gun control. They said that 58% of Americans now think gun laws should be made stricter, while 27% think they should be left as they are, and only 12% think they should be made less strict. That's a slight increase in those who are in favor of new gun laws from 52% in December of 2013. It's also interesting that Democrats, who tend to support gun laws more than Republicans, Democrats are more likely to say that gun laws are a very or extremely important issue to them, 69% to 55%. This indicates some kind of a big shift in America amongst attitude towards guns. I did interview Adam Lanka about the availability of guns and the association with mass shootings. I would like to interview somebody who is on the other side, who is a strong supporter of the U.S. Second Amendment. If anybody has a suggestion for a guest, please let me know. Scientific American recently published an article, "It's Not Just Paxil, Your Antidepressant Could Be Dangerous to Your Health." A brief extract. After many lawsuits and a 2012 U.S. Department of Justice settlement, last month an independent review found that the antidepressant drug Paxil, also known as paroxetine, is not safe for teenagers. The finding contradicts the conclusions of the initial 2001 drug trial, which the manufacturer GlaxoSmithKline had funded, then used its results to market Paxil as safe for adolescents. The latest study, published in the Journal of Clinical Epidemiology, evaluated 185 meta-analyses of antidepressants, found that one-third of them were written by pharma industry employees. The author, John Ioannidis, who's long been a critic of the pharmaceutical industry, stated, "We knew that the industry would fund studies to promote its products, but it's very different to fund meta-analysis. It's really amazing that there is such a massive influx of influence in this field." Now, I'd just like to give a word on a meta-analysis. Basically, if there's a lot of small studies of a particular drug, what somebody can do is come along, add up all the data, and reanalyze the data from many studies together. Statistically, this gives you much narrower statistical significance limits, confidence intervals, and you're more likely to be able to come to a statistically significant conclusion. The problem is that meta-analyses are very susceptible to bias. If drug companies only allow the studies that are positive to be published, then the meta-analysis will come to a positive conclusion, even though it's unwarranted. Continuing with the article, almost 80% of meta-analyses in their review had some sort of industry tie, and 7% of researchers had undisclosed conflicts of interest. There's a certain pecking order of papers, says Eric Turner, professor of psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University, who was not associated with the research and, I might add, was interviewed on this show about a year ago. Meta-analyses are at the top of the evidence pyramid. Turner was very concerned by the results, but did not find them surprising. Industry influence is just massive. What's really new is the level of attention people are now paying to the subject. And there are a few cracks. For example, with Paxil, it says he shouldn't be given to teenagers, but my assessment of the what I've read on antidepressants is probably nobody should be taking these drugs. They're very dangerous, and whenever there's a high-profile murder, with guns or without, there's very often it will state in the newspaper articles that this person was struggling with depression or was medicated or had just gone off the medications or just started medications, and often those medications are antidepressants. And now to our guest on the subject of addiction. Today's guest is Mark Lewis, a PhD neuroscientist and professor of developmental psychology at Radboud University in Holland, formerly at the University of Toronto for 20 years. He is also a former drug addict, author of the 2011 book Memoirs of an Addicted Brain, and the just published The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks very much, David.
I started by reading your 2011 book because at the time I heard about your new book, I couldn't get it because it hadn't actually been published yet. And you talked about your exploits as an addict, starting with alcohol, and you moved through illegal use of legal drugs, like hospital opiates and various illegal recreational drugs. I kind of felt stoned at the end of reading the story.
So yeah. Yes.
It seemed like you were either trying to find something or trying to escape from something. Is that what you eventually concluded?
Well, that's generally the case with addiction, right? I wasn't any different in that respect. Yeah, I was trying to find something. I was trying to find a sense of peace of mind. That's what people do, but whether it's substances or whether they're addicted to gambling, sex, porn, non-substances, behavioral addictions, they're looking to feel connected, centered, calm, you know, those kinds of things, psychologically in better shape. And what I was, I guess, escaping from, it started when I was in a boarding school, and I was miserable there. I was very unhappy there. And I kind of learned how to be depressed during those years. And then the depression went with me. So it was always part of my drug taking was an attempt to fend off depression.
I always had a biased view of boarding schools because I grew up in England, and pretty much every children's book I read was a child in a boarding school, like this trashy literature I read. And it was always like this ideal place where you had all this freedom. But I think the reality is often the opposite.
Often, yeah. This place was old school. I mean, maybe things have changed a bit, but it was paramilitary. We had to wear uniforms for some of the weeks after classes and stuff and go through drills. And it was also very Christian, and I was a Jewish kid, so I just did not feel right at all. And I don't know, I think my parents really goofed on that one.
Yeah, and did you feel like your parents sending you to a boarding school was an attempt to exclude you from their lives, that you were taking up too much time?
Like, yeah, I did. I think kids often feel that way. I certainly did. That's how I made sense of it, you know, what have I done wrong? Why am I so bad or hard to live with that you'd want to do this to me? And I don't think in retrospect that was the problem. They wanted to help me with my education. I was doing well, and the school had a great reputation academically, and we were planning a move to the States. So they thought that getting me into the American system a year early would help me. And in fact, it did save me a year of high school. So they had their reasons, but for my, it's like within the privacy of my own psyche, it was not good news.
It sounded devastating. Okay, so your new book is talking about why addiction is not a disease, and So, can you briefly describe, like, what do people who believe in the disease model believe about addiction? How could it be a disease? Like, it's not infectious. How does it qualify as a disease in their minds?
Yeah, good question. Well, I often ask that myself.
Okay.
Like, what are you guys thinking? It's partly that people do lose control to some degree, or talk about loss of control, and that is also the case with disease, that we can't control things very well when we have disease. There are brain changes. There are substantial changes in a small number of regions of the brain, but from my perspective, those can easily be explained by learning, because when we learn, we are also changing the brain. In fact, the brain changes massively with development over the adolescent years, and then even later in life, whenever we learn something intensely. So I see those changes as being good evidence for learning. I guess to give them the benefit of the doubt, they feel that the changes have reached a proportion or degree that is can should be termed pathological. And the addicts, I've never tried to look at the question exactly in this way. Like, how are you guys thinking about this?
Well, to me, I mean, a disease is something that has an external cause. So if I have a disease, I basically don't have responsibility for what's happened to me. You know, I got hit by a cosmic ray, now I have cancer. Maybe I'll go to a doctor and see if they can do anything about it, but it wasn't my fault, and there's not much I can do about it. Which seems like, if that's the, that to me seems one of the most damaging things about the disease model of addiction, is it kind of says you've got a disease, so we have to help you and just do what we tell you.
Exactly. So you know that you and I agree on this. That's very much the way I look at it.
I also I've noted that people often talk about in the disease model, they kind of say that the drug addiction is a consequence of the disease, right? You're self-medicating.
No, I don't think they say it as a, they say that the addiction is the disease. In fact, they say that the cause often is considered to be the drug itself. Well, that's an argument that they continue to make from NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health in the States. And they fund a vast amount, roughly 90% of addiction, biological addiction research in the world. Like,
Right.
a lot of, I mean, they're the National Institutes of Health, so they're all about, obviously, biological causes of disease. Well, they still define addiction as something which is caused by taking drugs, and it just doesn't even make sense when you recognize that gambling, sex addiction, porn addiction, binge eating disorder, many other eating disorders, not only are the same behaviorally and phenomenologically, subjectively, but they also look the same on a brain scan. They show activation in the same areas, and they show reduced activation in the same areas. So the drug cannot be the cause. So what is the cause? Well, okay, self-medication. Yeah. So the cause then is maybe you've had too much stress and in your rearing environment, in your growing up years, and therefore you're suffering from depression or anxiety, and therefore you take drugs to feel better. Well, that's fine. And psychiatrists can go with that. But then they would see that as, stress can also cause diabetes, for example. I
Right.
mean, or at least type 2 diabetes. And I think you can even trigger type 1 diabetes. I'm not sure what the consensus is on that. But so some diseases, well, heart disease, for example, obviously, and stroke and all that stuff can be thought of as a result of psychological factors. So I think that's how they get around those issues.
And the AA approach, that also basically buys into the disease model, right? But they consider it incurable. And is your evidence that people can, quote, cure themselves? I mean, and I guess it's hard to say that if you're not accepting the disease model. But are there people who, like yourself, I mean, do you feel that you're past the addiction, or do you take the AA attitude that it's every day at a time?
No, I feel I'm past it, but I still have to be careful when I take pain medications, because I still find them attractive, so
Right.
they still have the same appeal to some degree. But my life is organized in a completely different way. I'm not afraid that I'm going to start breaking into places again. It's just not even on the horizon. But so, yeah, for the AA, it's also a permanent chronic disease. And I think the reason people think that is because it is possible to quote, relapse, you know, 10 or 20 right. years later, like out of the blue. So people say, well, then it must be, you know, kind of in there somewhere. But I think that's very much like, like when people have a loving relationship and they break up and they stop seeing each other and they haven't seen each other for a very long time, and suddenly they meet somewhere and they still feel some feelings. I think it's that kind of thing. There are parts of your emotional software that haven't, you know, completely disappeared. And so they're still going to be reactive to some of the same cues or, you know, issues, events, whatever.
Right. And addiction also was related to life events, like loss of a partner, loss of a job, things like that. So if you've been clean for 20 years and then your life goes south, you know, your partner dies, you lose your job, all of a sudden your life's a mess again, one would imagine that that would be a vulnerable time for relapsing.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I mean, doctors are trained to think of things in terms of categories, diseases, symptoms, and things of that sort, pathology versus not. I'm a developmental psychologist by training, so I tend to see things in terms of development. The brain never, I mean, the brain develops, but it never goes backwards. So you don't ever completely erase synaptic activation patterns that were there at one time. You don't forget how to ride a bike either, or how to type a keyboard, even if you haven't done it for 20 years.
So,
And you're still excited by a kind of music that you might not have heard in 20 years. Right. So I think the synapses are still there, but there's nothing to do with the idea of a chronic disease.
So you believe that there are changes in the brain that occur because of the addiction. I was going to ask you, do the drugs cause these brain changes? But you're also talking about addictions to gambling and pornography where there is no drug.
That's right.
Let's say somebody gambles for the first time. Are some people getting more of a kick out of it than others? Like, how do you get into this? How do you get into the addiction in the first place?
Right. So, I mean, some people probably are more vulnerable than others for a variety of reasons. There's personality traits that have been shown to be to increase the likelihood of addiction. Things like impulsive personality style, mm-hmm. more impulsive. But it stands to reason, if you're more impulsive, you're also more likely to try bungee jumping or have unsafe sex as a teenager, right? Because you're impulsive.
Right.
So you're also more likely to try drugs, and if you're more likely to try them, you're more likely to get addicted. But there are other traits as well, perhaps frustration tolerance issues of sociability versus isolation. All of those things can, you know, be factors in the equation, but you can never use those factors in advance and predict that this person has this sort of thing, and therefore they're going to become an addict. There's no addiction gene. There's no cluster of genes that carry the addiction, the addiction itself. It just doesn't work like that.
Right. And I mean, an addiction, if I can think of it simplistically, you're kind of locked into a loop where you indulge in your addiction and for a period of time. And of course, you can't do it all the time. But then when you're not indulging, you're thinking about doing it again. So you watch porn, but then you got to go to work. But you might be thinking all day about, now I'm going to go home and watch porn again. Or a gambler who spends all weekend gambling and all week is thinking about going back to the casino.
Yeah.
What are the brain changes, in your opinion, that sort of lock you into this loop once you've got started?
So that's really important. So the brain changes are responsible it is a loop. It is indeed a loop. The more you think about it, the more you're reinforcing synaptic connections in regions where you conceptualize the addiction. And the more you pursue it, the more you are refining and consolidating synapses in regions that are responsible for goal pursuit. which is the area called the striatum. And, you know, all of these regions are designed for plasticity. They're supposed to be plastic. That's how we learn. That's how that's the way the brain works. So, and indeed, doing drugs is going to continue to refine the synapses, but so will thinking about it. And the more you think about it, the more you think about it. And the more you think about it, the more you do it. And the more you do it, the more you think about it. So the loop keeps going between behavior, cognition, and action. And they reinforce each other.
And does the brain get numb? Like, it seems that some people writing about addictions talk about how their first high with, say, heroin was the best they ever had, and they never get back to that. The more they do it, the sort of the less they get out of it, and the more they need to do it to get anything. Right. I mean, is that generally true, or are there some people who feel like sometimes they're getting the same high out of their drugs or their gambling that they got the first time they did it?
I think it's generally true. It's certainly one of the patterns. It doesn't necessarily mean the first time, but often, well, there's one simple principle, which is that if you do something over and over again, it becomes boring, right?
Right.
That applies to anything. So it's the same with drugs. If you do the same drug over and over again, it becomes hard to really notice how it's affecting you because you're doing it all the time. So you do have to do it more or differently or combine it with something else to get more excitement out of it.
I mean, in your personal experience, you went through a lot of different drugs. I mean, were you sort of searching for this getting a better high, or was it more opportunistic, this is the drugs that's easy to get right now?
It was both. I certainly had a preference hierarchy. I knew what I liked, and I knew what was just, you know, okay, and I knew what would do, you know, if I couldn't find anything else. So all those apply. You know, I mean, the other thing is your brain is changing in all kinds of ways. It does anyway, of course, as I keep saying, in adolescence, and especially in adolescence and early adulthood, which is when most people are getting into addiction. That's the age at which it happens. So, well, there are also changes in the parts of your brain that sustain your moral development, your personal development, your personality, your sense of yourself, how other people see you, the story of your life, the self-narrative, all the self-talk that we do all the time. So they're all changing also along with the addiction. And so that's why, you know, you can see it as a kind of a whole complex manifold of psychological processes that keep going on. Yes, the brain is changing, of course. But then the important thing to keep in mind is that people usually recover. Most addicts stop, and those stats are easily available. I'll send you a link if you want to the... There's been three waves of longitudinal research called NESARC, under the NESARC, National Epidemiological Study of Alcoholism and Related Conditions, I think it is. And just Google NESARC, and the stats are all there. Most people quit. Some drugs are easier to quit than others. Smoking is one of the hardest to quit, and of course that's one of the legal ones, so it's... people lose sight of these, or that doesn't come into the conversation, and it should. It's really important.
One thing I noticed, there was a common theme, like in your book, The Biology of Desire, you use a number of anecdotes or stories of individual people struggling with addiction. It seemed in your own story as well that sort of loneliness and a feeling of separation from society were an important factor.
Right.
And you also talked about this at the end of the book regarding suicide amongst Aboriginal children in Canada. Yeah. The tribes that had a big problem and the tribes that didn't.
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? How, you know, what were the factors in those children that caused them to be more or less likely to be suicidal?
Right. Okay, that's a pretty loaded set of things to talk. Let me try. I think I lost track of where you started.
Just talking about drug addiction. I felt that isolation and loneliness was
sort of
a common factor at the start of the process of becoming an addict.
Yeah. Okay, got it. So people have been talking about this more and more. Bruce Alexander is one Canadian person. I don't know if you know that name.
No.
He's the guy who did the Rat Park studies in the early 90s.
Okay.
Okay, so that's, and in those studies, what he showed was that when rats are isolated, when they're kept one to a cage, they will choose morphine over water and some other drugs as well. So they basically like to get high if they're in isolated cages. And everybody knows drugs make you get, you know, cause addiction, right? Well, wrong, because he took these rats, once they're addicted, put them in another much larger enclosure called Rat Park. They nicknamed it Rat Park, mm-hmm. in which they had a chance to hang out with other rats and socialize and play with rat toys. And they stopped. They voluntarily, most of them, stopped taking the drug that they were addicted to because they preferred the social interaction. So that was a big deal. Like he really showed that not only for humans but for other animals, isolation is incredibly stressful. And animals or people will do what they need to do in order to help soften the impact of that isolation.
And in the reaction to drugs in many societies, they take a penal attitude towards it, putting people in jail. And often, especially in the United States, that includes solitary confinement because of misbehavior.
Yeah. It's horrible.
Right. So what's the effect of that on the drug addict?
Well, it's just brutal. I mean, it's the most extreme form of cruelty to take someone who's already had a whole lot of problems with isolation and loneliness and probably had some difficulties in their childhood, whether from abuse or neglect, may have gone from one foster home to another. Now there's kind of a strong need to connect with other people, and you can't always find other people to connect with, so you take drugs instead at times, and then you get locked up and put in solitary confinement. It's you know, it's unbelievably cruel.
It seems to me that the disease model of drugs might have been a reaction to the punishment model, that if doctors could take control, they could say, look, it's not these guys' fault.
Yeah,
they have a disease, so they shouldn't be punished. That sort of seems a reaction to that model. I don't know what you think about that.
I think that's a good point. When I talk to people in the medical tradition, or to psychiatrists, and I say, you know, I don't think it's a disease, here's why, and then they often say, well, we need to call it a disease because that helps to reduce stigmatization. So they often use this word stigma. Okay, so if your husband is doing nasty things and no one can explain why, and then you recognize that he's got a disease, and that explains it, it takes a load off for him, takes a load off the marriage and maybe the family and so forth and so on. I think that argument was against the sort of more of the Victorian morality that has been, you know, fairly central in our feelings towards addicts. Well, now we've got a whole other problem built on that, because now it's not just about the moral issues. It's also, as you say, about the penal issues, which grew out of the war on drugs throughout the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, in a way, if doctors are enlightened enough to say that let's use the disease model as a way to argue against the incarceration of addicts, good, more power to them. Unfortunately, that's not really what's happening. They don't come out strongly and say, you know, we have to. I mean, well, to be fair, I mean, of course they would select treatment over jail, but it hasn't evolved that way within the debate that the disease model has become the primary alternative to locking people up. Rather, it's like an old fashioned remedy for an old fashioned problem, which is the Victorian morality issue. And I think there's a lot of other ways that we can help understand people and be nice to them and not add to their suffering, but try to help them through it, other than to say they have a disease.
And I mean, one of the things about one of the commonalities of diseases in the medical model is that the solution to a disease is a drug. And you do talk a little bit about that if you accept the disease model, then the search is on for the drugs that interfere with your addiction. Yeah,
right.
break the cycle. And what are your feelings on the use of pharmaceuticals to stop people's addictions?
There are some pharmaceuticals that are useful. There's two main types. One type is like an opiate substitution drugs like methadone in the old days, and now Suboxone, which is buprenorphine, which will suppress withdrawal symptoms. And so you don't have to go through that physical, very uncomfortable process. Well, that's going to make it easier to kick. So that's a good thing. But it's only good for opiate addicts. It's not doing a thing for coke addicts or meth addicts or gambling addicts.
Alcohol, pornography. It's very specific. And what's the success rate of these things in terms of getting people to want to stop taking their drugs?
It's complicated, but for the opiate substitutes, you know, some people will use them to get as a phase to get through the withdrawal period. Others will go on maintenance doses. As you know, they can stay on the stuff for years. I think it's okay. It's fine. It's better to stay on prescribed opiates rather than to go out in the street and have to find heroin that you never know what you're getting. You might OD, and you might have to pay an unseemly amount of money and turn to prostitution to get it. Much better to have it within the medical system. But it's obviously not it's not a deep solution to the problem. It's a kind of superficial solution to one aspect of the problem.
And what about the organizations like AA, Narcotics Anonymous? And I mean, I think there's an organization like that for just about every addiction.
Yes.
What's your feeling about this? Where they work, where they don't work?
Yeah, sure. And by the way, I should just also say with pharmaceuticals, there are a few others that are also useful for certain things. Some drugs help reduce craving, but they don't work terribly well, at least not for a lot of people. So again, I think there are small steps here. As far as AA, and they're not calling it XA because, as you say,
right,
letter can be anything. I think, I've read a lot about it. I've heard a lot of testimonials and arguments both ways. Some people are dead against it. People like Lance Stodes in his recent book, what's it called, The Sober Truth. Some people hate it. Other people love it. And there's always this huge, high-powered emotional war going on between supporters and detractors. I think that's just ridiculous. Like, if it's helpful for some people, it's great. And it does help some people. There's a lot of people it's not helpful for because that just doesn't work for them. It doesn't appeal to them. It's too dogmatic. It's too conformist. It's too whatever. It's too it has too many implications of old time religion. Even though some groups are not religious, it's true, but it still kind of has that aura about it. So when it works for people, great. Let them go there. The fact that it's so dominant. And that it actually is still the treatment of choice within residential rehabs, for example. These guys are charging, in the U.S., they're charging $50,000 to $100,000 a month. And what's their big, treatment innovation is sending people to meetings, to 12-step meetings. That's not fair.
Let's talk about rehab because basically AA is a voluntary process.
Right.
Where you go to it, and if you don't like it, you leave it, right? And one of the things it seems to deal with is the isolation and loneliness, because it is giving you people that you can relate to, that you can talk to openly about your issues and things like that.
Yes, that's right. So I think that part of it is great. And some colleagues say that, the 12 steps – are great, except for the 12 steps.
it's a little rigid. And I mean, there are nonconformists amongst us. Probably both of us are nonconformists and might not do too well with something that's very rigid. I mean, it's like how some people really like to go to a church-based religion, which is sort of very religious, very dogmatic in its beliefs and in the structure of the service and all of those other things. And other people want something a lot more touchy-feely, creative, different.
I think that's right. So there's that. And it's hard to paint a complete picture. I know people who are kind of more fringy who have been attracted to the 12 steps. The meetings vary a lot. Some groups are much more intellectual and agnostic, even, and they call themselves agnostic groups. Others not so at all. Some are more patriarchal. Some are really much more, shall we say, humanistic or, progressive. And it's like, it's a hodgepodge. And the fact that it's still so dominant within the rehab industry is a real problem, because there are so many other approaches that are probably going to be more effective for more people, like cognitive-based therapies, motivational interviewing, mindfulness-based approaches. I mean, these are showing a lot of promise.
Okay, so how would you describe this? I mean, is this done by some kind of therapist? You know, I walk in and I've been on heroin for a couple of years. I'm desperate to get off. Like, what? How would the process work in your mind? Sort of a more ideal process.
Yeah, well, in my book, I get to. You mentioned before the stories that I tell, the five addicts that I interviewed in depth for the book. I tell their stories in a lot of detail, because they're really very different in many ways. Different drugs, different people in different countries. But they all have real commonalities, too, in terms of difficult childhoods, all of the things that classically go with addiction, the impulsivity and the compulsivity and issues with control, and then, you know, self-hate, self-disgust, all that stuff. Why doing this to myself? Well, it wasn't until I finally got to the end of that and really thought about it a lot that I wrote the last chapter about what do I think treatment needs to do. And I think what it needs to do is, addiction is a way of trapping you in this kind of repeating present tense. You keep going after the same thing day after day after day.
Right.
And it's when you do that, you lose the sense of different possible futures. You lose the sense that you could be someone different next week. You stop reaching for a future. You start reaching for a future because you can't imagine a future other than just going on being addicted.
Right.
It's a very kind of insidious collapse, the way time kind of collapses into the present. And you also lose touch with the past if you've ever had it. That's where I get into the native groups and the suicide issues. Because in the groups with the high suicide rates, these were communities that had lost all touch with their own traditions. They basically had wiped out their past, and they were much more vulnerable to suicide and probably to addiction as well. So I think what you have to do, whether it's the social level, the community level, or in psychotherapy with one person or in a group, you have to help people stretch themselves so they can see their future stretching out in front of them, and they can understand their past and how did I get here? Oh, I went through that. Oh, I was miserable in boarding school. Oh, that's what I did. This is how I deal with stress. That's how I got into the situation. Now, you know, I think people need help with that, because it's a process that depends sort of on storytelling, on creating a narrative out of your life. And people need help. They need someone to talk to help them create the narrative and hold on to it during those difficult weeks when they're quitting.
So if you can connect to your past, like if we talk about the native children and the risk of suicide, if they start to learn more about their culture through stories, through learning about native traditions such as hunting and fishing and things like that, that can help them find a future connected to that thread.
In the native communities, it's a special case because we're talking about their cultural past. I think the cultural past enfolds the personal past for them, and I think that's what's going on. For people from, shall we say, mainstream culture, it's not so much about cultural issues, it's more about your family. Where did you come from? What was it like to be in your family? We're not very good at thinking about those things and becoming aware of that, except through processes like psychotherapy, talking about, you know, where does the pain and loneliness come from? And then people start to think about it, recognize it, and they start to see themselves more as a whole rather than this concatenation of parts.
I mean, one of the things I've always got when talking about addiction is that there's sort of a sense of hopelessness. It always seems like the success rate of like rehab is really, really low. And so it's kind of, I get the feeling like, well, this is an intractable problem, but we're going to keep trying because we have no other alternative. But you actually are talking about people. I mean, did all of the people in your book end up getting off their addiction?
Yes, all five.
Right. So there's a real sense of hope there that you can get away from this at some point.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, I didn't select the sample using scientific, you know, criteria for randomness or anything like that. I selected people who could talk really well about their addictions, and I wasn't even. It wasn't a criterion for me that they had actually finished recovery, because I didn't mind if they're still working on it. But it just so happened that for these five, they were all on the far side by the time I spoke with them.
And
the criteria for me was I wanted people who could talk, who could remember clearly what they went through it, and were at least comfortable enough to talk about it in detail.
And they used a variety of different methods, but they're, I mean, one of the components is they developed a desire to end it all, right? To end the addiction.
Well, that's the other thing that I think is absolutely key is let's take this desire of furnace, this part of the brain, the striatum, that is creates the problem in the first place because it gets all revved up for this particular one goal and basically derevved for all the other goals. Take that powerful beam of desire and use it. So when people have been addicted for several years, they really want to get off it. And there comes a point for everybody where it's just so awful, so boring and stupid and aversive that the desire to change is becomes very intense. And I think in treatment, we need to learn how to make use of that desire. Really just, you know, hone it and sharpen it like a spear or something, and use it to thrust forward into that person's future so that they can recreate that future according to the way that they now want to live their lives.
I think that's a really interesting observation. Like we all have irrational desire, whether it's for food or for, you know, a sexual partner or many different things.
Yeah.
And so I suppose when people
it's built in. We need to have desire. It's a really fundamental emotion for all us mammals is to go after our goals. It's so fundamental that it's almost, you know, it goes under the radar but there it is, and it drives your behavior from moment to moment and day to day.
Yes. I mean, I suppose it's like with, say, a sexual addiction. You can either be addicted to, you know, getting as much sex as you want and promiscuity and sort of an emptiness of not actually ever having a real relationship with your sexual partners, or you can try to build more excitement into your smaller number of relationships.
Yeah.
Which maybe satisfies your desire, because if we deny, I mean, maybe what some people are trying to do is deny that we have desire, right? You shouldn't have desire. It's bad. As opposed to something that should be managed.
Right. Unless the desire is for something very grand and principled and, you know, societally approved. But desire, the brain doesn't have, signposts as to what's good and what's bad, or, you know, what's acceptable and what's not. The brain just does what it does. And as you say, there are core desires for sex, connection, for food, for safety, and for nurturance. And that's what we have. Well, when those desires get tuned towards a drug or a substance or booze, that's the way you start to develop in that direction until it becomes impossible to sustain. And otherwise, if they develop in other directions, if you're lucky enough to be able to find people and connect with them in ways that work, then they don't go that way. They go in the other way, the way that, you know, obviously works better.
You commented that pharmaceuticals can be used to minimize desire, but I mean, that seems like a double-edged sword, because you actually want desire for more positive things. And if the drugs are just dulling you, it's kind of like giving a child in school who's bad, who's disruptive, giving them drugs, which causes them to be less disruptive, but might not actually be doing much good for the child.
Well, yeah, that's right. So there are the drugs that try to suppress desire in a more global way are not very effective. These would be drugs that try to reduce dopamine metabolism. They just don't work very well. Those kinds of drugs have been used for psychiatric for real illnesses like schizophrenia, and there's always a big price tag, is that they totally, you know, flatten the emotional landscape. Forget about those. But there are other drugs that specifically block opiate receptors. well, if you're addicted to opiates and if you've successfully blocked your opiate receptors, then you're not as likely to go out and get try to score some heroin, because it's not going to do you any good until that other drug clears the receptors. So that's very specific and targeted, and I think, yeah, it's great. It can work for some people. It can be part of the arsenal.
What about legalization? Like, I remember reading years ago how in England you could get a heroin prescription. I mean, I guess that wasn't exactly legalization, but it was felt by some people that if you could go and get your pharmaceutical-grade heroin every day, that you could actually live a normal life while being an addict. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I think that's I think it's true. You can live quite a normal life. In fact, I've known someone in particular. I knew a very close friend who was on large doses of opiates for many years. He still was very effective in his profession and reasonably effective as a family man too. It's hard to believe that he was. So I don't think there's anything intrinsically immoral or wrong about having addicts remain on a controlled dose of some substance. Maybe I'm not a very moral person, but I don't. For me, morality isn't the issue here. It's whatever works, and if that helps save somebody's life, so they don't have to go crawling around, you know, looking for something because they can't stop thinking about it. Well, fine, then let's do it. Let's give it to them. And as long as we control it so that you're not going to, you know, sell it to the guy next door, and I don't think that's going to happen most of the time, if it is really under control, right, then I don't see anything wrong with it.
I mean, one of the things with the war on drugs is it's very difficult to distinguish between the damage that the drugs are doing and the damage that the war is doing. Right. Certainly when it comes to deaths, I think the war on drugs kills more people than the drugs do. But it also encourages you to take very, very impure drugs because they're produced by criminals.
Yes.
which probably increases the damage that they do to the person.
Well, exactly. You sound like you might have read Chasing the Scream. Have you?
No, I haven't.
Well, you should, because, you don't need to because you already know this, but it's a really effective book by Johann Hari. It came out in this past year, and it's called Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. And it shows vividly and, you know, completely convincingly that the war on drugs has created a massive amount of damage. I mean, the whole country of Mexico has been completely deformed by the dominance of rival gangs. The number of people in jail in the U.S., obviously, it's insane. The amount of the violence when there's strong demand for something, you can't cut off access. We know that from prohibition. Prohibition didn't work in the 30s, and the war on drugs has never worked. It's never reduced drug taking.
Well, so, it depends what you mean by works. If you're running a company that's making $1 billion off the war on drugs, to you, it's working really well. and you would hate the war to end.
Okay, then it's working well for, as you say, criminals.
Yes.
And it's working tremendously well for the criminals. You're right. But as Johann Hari says in his book, you don't see the president of Seagram's and the president of Johnny Walker, you know, involved in drive-by shootings trying to kill each other.
Yes.
Because, right? Or board members either, because, you know, it's all sorted out and we can both make money off booze because it's legal and, you know, that's what we do.
I mean, it still causes damage to society, but we learned the hard way that if you say, okay, alcohol causes damage, therefore we're going to ban it, it just gets worse.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's still alcohol around.
Exactly. So even during prohibition, it's always around. Drugs are around, and people get it. But as you say, they get impure stuff that with unknown quantities, so there's much higher risk of overdose. So you get a lot of dead teenagers on your hands.
Well,
that's not much of an advantage.
Right. One of the things you said was that the motivational engine of the brain matures before the guidance system is complete. You were talking about teenagers, I think, at that point. And so if drugs are illegal, then teenagers have the same access as everyone else. But if they're legalized, presumably there would be a minimum age at which people could buy the drugs. So they would have less access.
Yeah. And throughout the Western world, everywhere that we go, there are limits on drinking age. young people below a certain age cannot walk into a bar or a liquor store and get booze. So often people obviously know how to get around that, but we can try to control access for young people. That has nothing, and you can't even try to do that if they're getting stuff off the street.
Right, right. Which is when they're most vulnerable to this. But even if we legalize things, like one in an ideal world, like if I was an idealist, which I am some of the time, but definitely not all of the time, you might say, well, if the heroin was legalized and somebody could get a prescription, then eventually they wouldn't need the heroin anymore because they're dealing with problems in their life that they could deal with, right? They could get a job, they could have a relationship, their life could go on normally. I mean, do you think that would happen if somebody was given heroin every day, like the rats, and their life turned around and now they weren't in the struggle? Do you think people would stop the heroin?
Well, interesting question. So, one of the sort of natural experiments on that is in Portugal, where they have decriminalized all drugs, right, all recreational drugs, and addiction rates have gone down. They've gone down significantly. I think they're about half what they were. So that's a real challenge to people who believe that criminalization is the way to go. Now, why do people stop when it becomes more available? It's hard to say. In a way, it may give them a chance to relax and live less chaotic lifestyles. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have to struggle every day to get this thing, this bloody thing that you just need to feel okay, you might have more time to reflect, consider, meditate, try other things, and work your way back into, you know, into society, into some kind of cultural connection that works for you. So, yeah, I think that's quite possible. On the other hand, you're still going to get some people that are going to say, okay, all I really want to do is keep taking this drug for the rest of my life. And, okay, fine. For some people, that might be the answer.
Yeah. I mean, the argument is those people wouldn't have the drug if we made it illegal, but I suspect those are the people who would get it no matter.
Exactly. They would get it, and with it they would get, you know, HIV and Hep C and, you know, everything else that goes with it. So they'd also get a whole lot of suffering. It doesn't really have to be part of the package.
And it seems to me that what you described in the anecdotes in your book, the anecdotes in the book was that the drugs were themselves isolating.
Yeah, it's true.
Which is reinforcing the fact that people got into it because they somehow were isolated.
Yeah, I think it's true that these people, each of them had certain issues growing up that caused it to feel more isolated, and the drugs made it worse, made them more isolated, more disconnected. For Johnny, it was, he would connect with people at the pub, you know, so he had some social contacts, but he couldn't connect with people other than around alcohol, and even that amount of contact began to just fade away as he got into more and more heavy alcoholism and just couldn't stay upright in his chair. So I guess you're right that use itself can be a source of disconnection, but it's a kind of complex formula, and it's not a simple one.
Yes. Well, we've pretty much run towards the end of the interview time, so are there a couple of last points that you'd like to make before we wrap up?
Well, we have covered an awful lot.
Yes.
So you've asked a lot of really good questions. So let me think.
I mean, yeah, if you can sort of summarize the big lessons that you learned from writing this book.
I mean, I hope people do, you know, of course, I hope they buy the book and read it. I think it's a good book. What I try to do in the book is to use the stories of these people's lives. I tell the stories in a very kind of realistic way, which is often suspenseful and dramatic, because let's face it, their lives get pretty suspenseful when they're in the thick of it. So this is to show what it's like to be addicted and what it's like to be in recovery and working your way out of it, out of addiction. But at the same time, I do talk about the biological processes, so I throw in a few pages of biology with each chapter, and that helps to explain, you know, why does the system work like this? Why is the brain the kind of a system that can attach itself to one goal with such tenacity you know, at the expense of a whole lot of other goals that should also be important. How can that work? How can that happen? So I try to explain the neural processes involved using all the, you know, all the up-to-date literature, scientific literature, and really make this connection between lived experience and the science of addiction, because that's what often goes missing. Most people, either they're into the science of addiction and all they care about is, you know, the patches of color in an fMRI scan, or the stats that flow from those patterns, and other people just care about the experience. And there's millions of addiction memoirs out there, lots of people telling their stories. But I really do think that it's valuable to knit these two worlds together, the science and the experience.
Right, that does make it unique. Like, from my perspective, I think you described well the ugliness of it, of addiction. Like, you didn't sugarcoat it. Yeah, their addictions are pretty ugly, and you also described that getting out was difficult, but you also gave people hope that it is possible for an individual to end their addictions, sometimes with the help of other people, sometimes through you know, hitting bottom and sort of picking themselves up and doing it all by themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
definitely an interesting book.
Thanks. I'm glad you liked it. And I think other people are also coming online in different ways and kind of joining the chorus of voices that are moving the field away from where it is now. It's kind of stuck in this medical / 12-step swamp towards much more socially informed, humanistic, and progressive ways of thinking about addiction and helping addicts get better.
Yeah, a lot of things are changing right now, so it's important to really think about the whole issue of addiction. So thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was great talking to you, and thanks for inviting me.
Okay. Goodbye, Mark.
Okay. Bye, David. Take care.
Thank you for listening to episode 79 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. And on the podcast page on Podbean, you can actually add comments, so that's another avenue to communicate. This week, I have a special offer. The best comment that I receive in the week following the broadcast of this episode, if you send me your mailing address, and as I said, the best comment of the week, I will send you a copy of The Biology of Desire by Mark Lewis, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. It's almost new. It was read once by me to prepare for the show. But if you don't mind maybe a couple of pages being slightly dog-eared, it's pretty much brand spanking new. And if you're interested in addiction, I'm sure you'll enjoy this book. So send me a comment with your mailing address, and maybe you'll be that lucky person. Until next week, goodbye.